4 or 5 years ago, I was reading, I believe, Tricycle magazine, and there was an article by a fellow named Richard Esko, who was writing an article about a question that I had been reflecting on for some time, and I thought I would sort of make this a question for all of us tonight. And that question is, in an age where there is such absolute belief in data, that data is the proof of everything, how do we stay true to insight teachings? Is it only valid if there's data that backs it up? Is data itself insight? What is all of this? How does this all relate? We went from the age of information, you know, to the age of data. So there was an information age, and now we're in the data age, and one of my friends has written a beautiful photojournalism book called Big Data. You know, it's like, this is the time in which we're living. So, there's a traditional hierarchy that has been suggested by others, Adler among others, about the way to rank data in relation to things like insight, and trying to state this question in modern language, I ended up saying that what I was going to be speaking about tonight is the input hierarchy dilemma. I don't even know what word to use, because each of the words you use in there, of knowing equal in some way, or is there truly a hierarchy or not? So this input, I looked all these words up in the dictionary because it's so confusing, and I think that's part of what's happening to us. Is input is a noun, means details, information, data, material, fact, figures, statistics, particulars, specifics, informal information. All of that is considered input. Input into what? In our instance, input into what would help us have well-being, what would help us move from creating suffering in our lives and the lives of others, and ceasing to create suffering in our lives and the lives of others, to what allows us to move from the kind of attachment, grasping, the tanha or thirst of the second noble truth, to this lack of thirst in this world. And so what input is valuable to that? How do we organize all the input that comes in all of these various ways? And this is particularly true in the age of what is called secular Buddhism, secular mindfulness, where mindfulness has become a valued skill and being defined in all these different ways, and so many different aspects of our society now, and taught by, you know, some thousands of people now with varying degrees of understanding of what the origins of mindfulness, which all flowing out of this, of course, the Buddhist approach to mindfulness, this was the source of all of this, but now it's flowing through all of these minds that may have never gone to a retreat, that never went to a retreat at all, and they're teaching people how to be mindful. And so how does all this work? So the second definition of input that was in my computer's dictionary versus the British dictionary, I thought that was interesting because they were different, is the contribution of ideas. So input can be the contribution of ideas, advice, and opinions. That's giving someone input. So in a way, that's what teaching is, in a way, right? Contribution of ideas and advice and opinions. And as a verb, then, input means to feed in, put in, load, insert, key in, enter, code, store. That all sounded very cold to me. When I'm teaching, I don't think of it that way. When I'm listening, I don't think of, oh, someone's putting in, loading, and inserting all of this. But still, I want to be with the modern age. So this exploration we're going to do tonight ties into something I've taught in this Sangha. It's been some years now. But I talked for a long time about the difference between information and knowledge and wisdom and mastery. Some of you will remember that, and I'll tie it back in again tonight if we have time. So this hierarchy that has been suggested, that is often used, is that there is data, there is information, there's knowledge, and there's wisdom. Data leading to information, leading to knowledge, leading to wisdom. That's a hierarchy, a pyramid of input. Not everybody would agree with that. And not everybody would. That when you look in the dictionary, what you find is that these words are defined by each other to a large degree, which is for liberation purposes, not so helpful. I don't know about in terms of other purposes. So information information is like details, facts, figures, this sort of thing. And knowledge is referred to as applying to a body of facts gathered by study or observation or experience. So knowledge is a group of facts. And so you start with data. Data is, there's the statistics, there's numbers, there's something. The easy example is around blood pressure. So there's been all of these tests of mindfulness for various purposes, including relief of stress, lowering blood pressure, all of which it does. And we know this because people have gathered data. And then someone has interpreted that data and said, well, this gives us this piece of information, that practicing mindfulness meditation lowers blood pressure. That mindfulness, practicing mindfulness meditation reduces stress. And here's the proof of it, because here's all these data points that does that. That is very reassuring if your belief is in data. In that way, yesterday in doing the day for care providers, I do this because this is a chance. I feel privileged to get to do it, but it's a chance to thank the various people that provide care in the larger Bay Area community. It's just so I do it the same every year. Started this 15 years ago. Started out with this extended period of thank you, thank you, thank you, for that, whether it's professional care providers or what's called personal or family care providers, and then we go into to the things that help. The whole day is about resting and the way that you get revitalized and renewed, both in purpose and energetically, and then I present a set of skills that help you. I'm presenting a kind of information that helps you, based on the knowledge I have, that can help with this. So I usually give a handout, and this year it was four part. The first was called the Mani Power Meditation, and it shows the like an Venn diagram. This overlap of mind, body, and spirit. And then the second article was this meditation boosts creativity. And the data says that, yes, it does. And I had this here in part because I, earlier in my presentation, had talked about they've done this measurement that shows that wandering mind, not really being present when you're moment to moment, that that is counterindicated in relation to happiness. The less the wandering mind, the more you're going to report being happy. And but wandering mind, they used that term in the article I was quoting, but wandering mind doesn't mean being like letting your mind meander for purposes of creativity. It means that when you're doing one thing, you're thinking about something else. You're not really being mindful of what's actually at this moment's like this. So I wanted to have that article. And then the third article was from the Harvard Business Review that says mindfulness can literally change your brain. And it has its own little photographs of your brain getting changed. And I brought copies, not for everybody, but I brought about 20 copies. For those of you who are interested, you can take it with you, and someone can take this one also at the end of the evening if you like. So so in doing this, I was presenting data, or let's say I was presenting information that was based on data. Knowledge is knowledge is an understanding, a comprehension, so you can have information but not really understand it. You can have information that's based on real data, so it's real information, but not really understand it. And then wisdom is the use of knowledge towards your goal, from my point of view. So one of the things that came out, I always bring one or two or three people to help. Art usually is there, but couldn't be there this time, to help with do individual sessions with people, because people bring so much suffering to these care provider decks. And yesterday was no exception to that. It's very tough being a care provider, and a lot of people that are care providers professionally are also heavily involved in some personal care providing, and it's real dukkha. It's real dukkha. So we're really happy to help in that way. And but one of the things that my team reported back this year was that there was also a lot of misinformation in terms of how to practice with certain difficulties. And this was like a new thing. This had never come up as, I mean, there would be an occasional person who was practicing in a way that was not going to help them very much based on all of our experience, but not as a across-the-board experience. And so when I was hearing this, we meet at lunch and I hear how it's going. And my suspicion was that because mindfulness is being taught now so widely by so many people, that people are teaching things that they're not giving a complete teaching, or they really didn't understand what they heard somewhere, and then they thought they heard something, but they're not around to hear it said over and over again. Which, you know, when you're in the Dharma, you hear the same thing over and over and over, and that, deliberately so. It was an oral tradition. That was the whole. That's how it was kept alive. So that there was some degree of increase in misinformation. So people were practicing in ways that was actually adding. It was not skillful to relieve their suffering, to relieve their agony. And this was like a different kind of thing than the people that helped me were accustomed to. And now, I would call that amount of sampling from one day, I would not call that enough sampling to be real data. Like if we're going to have real data, we'd have to have a lot more data points, right? Because that's what we do now. We have a lot of data points. And yet we know also, as was true in the last election, that the data that seems to be there is not really registering what's the truth of a situation. That it was something about the data was not really giving knowledge as to how what was really going on among the electorate. So it's this thing about data and finding the right use of it and the right balance of it. So, and then we get to wisdom, and wisdom is a kind of intelligence or sense of something, how to apply it, a kind of judiciousness in relation to knowledge in terms of how it's used. It's like wise use of knowledge, that wisdom takes it to a larger level, and how of usefulness, whether it's with an individual around a specific thing, or you know, for a group of people, or a whole system, or a whole some role in the culture. The dilemma I feel that we have, and that we can easily fall into in our practice, is that we can get. We can start to reduce our entire meditation practice to that which is defined in data terms. Okay, it lowers blood pressure. It changes the brain in X or Y way. At least for some people, some of the time, or at least the average, or something like this. We can start to say, well, what is practice is what can be shown by data. And so is that going to serve us? Not that there's anything wrong with the data that can inspire us, that can give us confidence. It can help create the placebo effect and all of that. So I'm not against it, but just finding for each of us ourselves, finding what we're going to pay attention to in practice. And then in the same way, there's information out there now. There's information that has been shared and shared again and shared again that may be based on a lot of data, but may not be based on data so much as experience. It was based, there's information that someone had an experience, and from that experience they go, okay, this is information I can give to someone. But then the person hearing it, are they, and then if they turn around and share it, Is it still at the level of knowledge, or is it information in the way that there is fake news? Do we start to have in our mindfulness community fake information, not deliberately so, but out of shallow exposure? So someone's writing a blog and they've gone to a class on mindfulness. They wanted to share what they've learned. That's great, but what have they learned with that level of exposure? That then all the people that read their blog now they think that. And again, this I would say that's what we were seeing yesterday in this thing. The goal of practice can get reduced if we're not careful. Mindfulness, in its origins, was not conceived of as a wellness technique. It just wasn't conceived of that way. It so happens that the data points to the fact that it does bring wellness. It is a good health technique, you know. But is that really how we're going to hold it? Again, it gets harder not to hold it that way in a society where it starts to be being held that way. The idea freedom, this kind of freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion, which is actually a hard point, but it seems soft and squishy. But I can tell you from personal experience and hearings in, I don't know, a couple thousand testimonials of people having experienced this movement in a data point way from less moments of great hatred and delusion. But when you try to say that, show me your evidence. You know, see, it's trying to prove something maybe at the wrong level, and so we kind of go, okay, well, just you know, I'm just going to learn to calm myself, and then that'll just bring less great hatred and delusion. There's truth to that to a degree, but it is limiting the scope of what we're opening to possibility. The well-being that comes from this practice is this word sukha, this kind of happiness. The sukha versus the dukkha, the suffering, the unsatisfactoriness that the Buddha talks about in the First Noble Truth. The sukha, that kind, the happiness. There's regular happiness. That's when things are the way we want them, which is sometimes called dukkha sukha, where the conditions are temporarily the way we want them. You know, like the weather's good and the body's not hurting and so forth. Then there's that kind of what's called anicca, a sukha, where which I talk about in that last chapter of Dancing with Life, where your conditions may not be as you would like them, but you just got this mind state right now. It's water off the duck's back. The person that always gets to you just doesn't get to you this day. You know, that friend that kind of gets on your nerves. You just see her, she struggles so much, and she doesn't get to you. Or, you know, that you're late because of traffic. You just, okay, I'm late. It just doesn't get to you. It's sukha and nicha, because, of course, that won't last. Those mind states don't last. And then there's sukha-sukha, this kind of happiness that is a kind of well-being that's not actually, it would be more what I would call joy than happiness. Because I think of happiness more condition-based. And I think of liberation as not condition-based, but this inner change in a way that's not dependent on neither the conditions or the temporary mind state, but it's a sense of well-being that's tying into this. What I say is the well-being that's always there, whether you think that or not, whether you cultivate it and it emerges, or is there and we're just getting access to it. Either way, it didn't matter. That's sukha sukha in that way. And so if we're going to, for us in our own practice and in our community, it would seem to me that we would want to make sure that we're oriented towards much more wisdom, this knowing how to apply knowledge wisely in this set of circumstances for this particular goal, then we would be interested in just the having knowledge, and certainly than just information. So we start out needing information. We just need to know how to practice, and we need information if it's information that's proving practice works, that can be helpful. We start out that way, but then we need knowledge. Knowledge, we're wanting to acquire knowledge that we can really, this knowledge will really give us an orientation. We're basic. We know that this is what matters. We know that this works, and we know how to do it. Even if we don't do it very well yet, we know how to do it. And then gradually, from applying knowledge over and over again, there comes insight, or what I would call wisdom, spiritual wisdom, or well-being, non-contingent well-being, wisdom, or non-contingent insight, liberating insight that brings non-contingent well-being. And in that way, when we're starting out with information, the challenge is to find information that's reliable. And that may be becoming harder, so we have to be more careful ourselves about where we look for information. And then as we kind of understand how to practice and so forth, then with knowledge, we're gaining our own knowledge in time, but also we're depending on the knowledge of other people. And so there's a level of discrimination about where we get our knowledge. And it can vary also as to what we're interested in, as to where we get this knowledge. And then when we get to the wisdom level, to me, the Buddha is pointing to our achieving our own wisdom. And we certainly benefit. It's much easier if we have teachers who have some degree of wisdom, because from their wisdom, they see where we are and they can offer knowledge and information that would help us. We don't need them. Their data, they do have data points that they are referring to from their own experience, their experience and the experience of their teachers. So there's an implicit data point, but we're not looking for, we want to see the reams of data that says, yes, this will bring the end of greed. We're trusting experience as a kind of data. So it's moving from a worldly measurement to an individual measured, ourselves and those people that we trust. And then going back then to the thing that I've talked here actually twice, is there's information teachers, very useful, as long as that information is sound. There's knowledge teachers, again, useful. There are wisdom teachers who really have a degree of wisdom, and they really know. They really know. And so they're sharing at that list. They're sharing a level that it is wisdom and can inspire us to have moments of wisdom. And then and from a teacher point of view, I refer to mastery. And the difference between a teacher that's at the wisdom level is they really understand, they've really had the insight, but they can't live it out. Whereas a master can live it out. And so you find varying degrees of mastery among teachers in every tradition, every spiritual tradition. There's a lot more people who've attained some level of wisdom than there are people who have some degree of profound mastery. It's just natural. It's that, again, that pyramid. Fewer and fewer people are going to have spent the time and had the conditions and the good fortune and all to do that. So we're in the midst of all of this. So I'm gonna read you a few poems here. My mind, this is E.D. Cummings. My mind is a big hunk of irrevocable nothing, which touch and taste and smell and hearing and sight keep hitting and chipping with sharp, fatal tools in an agony of sensual chisels. I perform squirms of chrome and execute strides of cobalt. Nevertheless, I feel that I'm cleverly am being altered, that I slightly am becoming something a little different. In fact, myself. So he's becoming himself. Hereupon, helpless, I utter lilac shrieks and scarlet bellowings. So is he giving us data or information or knowledge or wisdom? When you listen to that, what are you listening to? What is that?
Not all of them?
You could say it's all of them. Yes, you could say that. Pardon me?
Sounds like information to me.
Yeah. So I, someone else? Anyone else?
Knowledge.
I think it's more somewhere between knowledge and maybe some wisdom too, somewhere in there.
It's so to me, the wisdom in it, he is saying that he's doing these things to change himself, and he's got some degree of knowledge about how to do that, and the wisdom level would be saying, and it's slightly working for some mysterious reason. So, okay, I'll go on.
What's the name of that poem?
My Mind Is. You may see one or more of these at Poetry Day, so don't be shocked if it comes back around. And by the way, Poetry Day is July 16th this year. I still don't have a theme, although I'm getting much closer, and Liz has been of aid to me in this process. So this is by William Stafford and called It's All Right. Someone you trusted has treated you bad. Someone has used you to vent their ill temper. Did you expect anything different? So now what's that? If we stopped right there.
Wisdom.
Okay, that could be. Your work, better than some others, has languished or neglected. Or a job you tried was too hard and you failed. Maybe weather or bad luck spoiled what you did. That grudge held against you for years after you patched up has flared and you've lost a friend for a time. Things at home aren't so good. On the job, your spirits have sunk. But just when the worst bears down, you find a pretty bubble in your soup at noon. And outside at work, a bird says, "Hi." Slowly, the sun creeps along the floor. It is coming your way. It touches your shoe.
That's
non-contingent well-being. That would be, to me, at the wisdom level. So he's not giving us information here. He's reflecting our life experience, because he's got a certain knowledge of how life is. But then he's not then taking that knowledge and going back to information. He's pointing to a kind of wisdom of how to live. That's the way I would hear it.
So in your hierarchy, would you equate insight with wisdom?
I would say that wisdom comes from insight. In the traditional hierarchy, they don't use the word insight. I'm using that. I'm imposing insight in there.
Philip, what was the name of the Stafford poem?
It's All Right. This is an excerpt from a Mary Oliver poem. You're going to ask me, so I should go ahead and tell you. The poem is called In Blackwater Woods. Everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation. Whose meaning none of us will ever know. I'm going to read that again. I'm having a little trouble with my breath here. Everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. To do three things, to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go.
Wisdom.
Okay, what else? So three things, isn't that knowledge? Isn't that knowledge? So there's a level of knowledge there that will lead you to wisdom. That would be, you could say that's wisdom. That you have to have that level of knowledge is wisdom, or you could say that level of knowledge leads to wisdom. It's a personal experience. There's information. There's three things here, so that you could say, well, then this is information. These are the three things you need to do. That's the information level of this. But it dies at the information level. It goes flat. It's one little shortcuts in life. Do you see what I mean? It's little.
There's some insight.
Oh yeah, no, that's the wisdom. Yeah, but she's had insight that this, that you know, that that what she says mortal, meaning in Nietzsche, that everything's going to change. But even though everything's going to change and it's going to desert you or you're going to desert it, you still got to hold to it. Like, this is the only thing that matters because it is. And then you have to let it go. Very Buddhist teaching. Very Buddhist. For her to really know that, if she really knows it, which let's assume she has this kind of wisdom, then she has had insight into life at this level. But then, as knowledge, you would explore those three things. Do I understand that? Do I agree with it? I'm gonna try this out for a week. I'm just gonna look it out. So at that point, it's not your insight. You're taking this piece of knowledge and seeing if it works. You're getting information through data in your own life. You're saying, okay, does this really line up to me? And does it not just, is it accurate intellectually, but is it forward leading for me in my life?
But we know that from the poem. I mean, we could assume that that's what she's done, but we really don't know that from reading the poem.
But you don't know also if this framework, framing it this way, will work for you. It might work for her and it won't work for you. Mm-hmm. So she is... I don't know if I'm communicating any of this or not. There has to be a harmony, a resonance. I use that word resonance during the guided meditation. There has to be a resonance for us that, oh yeah, this there's a resonance. I am brought into harmony here. Holding something in this frame, holding my own growth, how to meet life in this frame has harmony for me. It leads to well-being. Otherwise, it's information about what works for her.
But if the poem resonates upon hearing it and something is touched and something opens up because we hear it, we're recognizing the truth. And rather than having to go forward and study whether it's true for us, can't we say that's true for me too when you hear it?
Yeah. So in hearing the poem, there's an immediate resonance. Mm-hmm. And so then you say, but is this, and at that level there's some knowledge, but is it sustaining resonance? Would be the wisdom level. This sustains me. Because lots of times we are touched, but it's emotional. But it has no ground to it. It isn't onward leading. Because she's given us three things to do. It's not like a moment, like I saw, you know, in the previous poem, the bird says hi. That's an emotional moment. She's not doing that. She's saying these three things are what matter. And so you're touched by it. But then to make it your own, you then explore that for yourself. So you take the authority. Because she's got her own chain of data points that led to information, that led to knowledge, and this is wisdom for her that she's sharing. But it may touch you and inspire you to get your own wisdom, but this may not be the frame that would lead you in a sustained way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Perfect. As all this information is out there, it can pull us away from this deeper exploration, this further communion to a deeper union. Again, to quote Eliot, we can get dumbed down by the amount of information, and we lose the through line of what we're really about. Okay, so last one. If all a, this is by Robert Bly, it's called Anniversary. If all a man does is to watch from the shore, then he doesn't have to worry about the current. If all a woman does is to watch from the shore, then she doesn't have to worry about the current. If all they do is watch from the shore, then they don't have to worry about the current. But if affection has put us into the stream, then we have to agree to where the water goes. So, if affection has put us into the stream, we're not on the shore, now we're in the stream, then we have to agree to where the water goes. That I don't consider to be, I would consider, well, actually, you say what you think it is for you for a moment.
First of all, when you're, if it's just a man or just a woman, then who are they going to agree with if there's a couple?
Well, I was using they and the thing of the gender language.
I understand that, but I'm saying if it's just an individual, who are they going to agree with themselves?
They happen to agree with the water, the flow of the water. If you're going to get into anything in life, everything's going somewhere. There's a stream, and you have to. You need to think this through for yourself. I don't want to explain it here tonight. But this is. I would not call this. This is a kind of. This is like information and wisdom, in a certain way that there's like. This is saying, figure this out for yourself. Right? It's a kind of koan. That's right. That's based on a whole set of things, but it's given you a piece, it's given you a piece of information to explore in a certain way. Is that true or not? Yes. Yes, then we have to agree, A-G-R-E-E, to where the water goes. That's not what he wrote. Yeah, I understand. And that doesn't... I don't want to get into a discussion of the meaning of this because I'll save this for poetry day. The way we relate to what we read or hear, to be present, for how are we relating to this? What is being called forward in me, and what is the appropriate way of relating to whatever this is? I am touched by it, but then still, what's the appropriate way? Oh well, this person's giving me lots of data points. So, but then how am I supposed to relate to it? If someone gives me a lot of data points, do I accept that as the reality that this is how I'm supposed to relate to this?
What interests me is that with all of these poems, or with most poems, different times of life you relate to them.
That's right. Or even different days.
Different days. And it relates, it awakes different kinds of wisdom.
Right. And that's, that we'll go back to that in Poetry Day. I've got a new quote for the beginning of Poetry Day. I guess what motivated me here is a kind of cautionary, let us be cautious. Let us be cautious and awake to how we're relating. From 1893, or whenever that World's Fair was in Chicago, where Vivekananda came over and woke the states to yoga, to somewhere in the 70s or somewhere like that, yoga had a thrust that was towards depth. Over the last 20 years or whatever, as it became widely available everywhere, it lost that thrust towards depth to a large degree, so that if you... Used to, when I was young and you went to a yoga class, that depth was implied, even if the teacher couldn't do it. It was in the context of the depth. You go into most yoga classes now, there is no implication of the depth. So there's not an invitation to go deeper. And yet the tradition is incredibly deep. Mm-hmm. It's just incredibly deep. This is happening. There are people now, I've listened to them talk, where they think they know what mindfulness is, and it's not related to the whole thrust from which it came. It's not that it's a bad thing, it just doesn't have anything to do with the end of suffering in the same way. It has more to do with advantage. So the invitation is for you to think for yourself about this and just watch what's happening to you. Again, I'm not against data point. I'm not against having these brain images that show this change and all this. I'm not against that. But that isn't the point. That's not the point. It's just some data pointing to proof of concept. But concept of what? Not that we can lower blood pressure. I mean, that's not the purpose of mindfulness. But you can get conditioned into thinking, oh, well, this, you know, I'm going to have these little things about life that way. So that's the. I don't know if this was at all useful.
Analogy with yoga was really helpful. Oh, I've seen how that's just hijacked into
an exercise. I stopped teaching yoga, except when I continued in the prison system for a while, because I couldn't stand it when people got up off their mats and abandoned everything that they were experiencing in the way that would lead to any kind of an insight. I just couldn't stand it. Because the way I taught yoga, as you would expect, very slow, very holding the poses, finding the still point, all these things that I couldn't stand the insult to the tradition in that way. And whereas if someone goes to a dance class and gets all relieved and all this, I think that's terrific. And if that's what people want with yoga, that's okay too. I didn't want to do that. That wasn't. Yoga, that wasn't what yoga was to me. It led me deeper. It was yoga that led me to Buddhism and so forth. So I was being true to me, you see. I wasn't judging in terms of someone else. I was appraising for myself. And what I'm pointing to here is for each of you to like appraise with what, I don't know what each of you want to do. Maybe you come here because just being still is so relief in a week, and that's great. But it's coming from this deeper tradition. We have to stop here.
The same thing is happening with Tai Chi.
Isn't some of it just part and parcel of our culture, the way we distill everything and try to make money off
of it? It's part of commercialization, yes. We're monetizing mindfulness, really at big time. Big time. I mean, because if you get one of these mindfulness jobs in a company, I mean, you could be in six figures. You're six figures teaching mindfulness. Yeah. No. I don't want to talk more about this. I want to end on time. We're close to on time. So we got to stop here now. So let's just let this go for a moment. Let's come back into our bodies. In the meditation, I was pointing us to this natural fruit of our practice of just be, and the well-being that is innate in this embodied awareness that is not needing greed, not needing any kind of aversion, not having to hide out in delusion. This innate well-being. And then the teaching was a reflection on keeping our own priorities straight, keeping our own authority, not allowing our practice to be culturally defined in a way that makes it a commodity or a commercialization, but is a path, the Eightfold Path. Without having to condemn or judge anybody else, just what's important to us, how we want to understand and recognize data, how we want to understand and recognize information. Wise use of it, true recognition of it, how we want to be able to recognize what is true knowledge versus a bunch of information, even if that information is based on reliable data. We're looking beyond information to something that leads to real knowledge, and then real knowledge that leads to wisdom and compassion, really.